History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that might just raise your eyebrows a little bit, stories that might just inspire you, and you're never going to hear them unless we take a little time to ask some questions and listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And yeah, we sure do learn a lot in that journey. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Arroyo Grande, California, with almost 93-year-old Dick Grantham. Coming up July 11th, he's going to celebrate that birthday. He's been here for more than a half century on California's Central Coast, but originally from Southern California, born in the Bay Area in Oakland, grew up in L.A., and we're going to hear about his time in the Navy in World War II, and I've just spent the last few minutes being amazed by his handiwork all over his home that he and his wife built here in Arroyo Grande. There is oak cabinetry and all kinds of incredible woodwork. He has antique phones from 38 years with the phone company. I don't know what he doesn't have in this home, but we're going to get to know Dick Grantham today. So, Dick, let's go way back to your childhood. I guess you really never got to know your father, right?
No, I didn't know. He left us when I was 2 years old, and then my mother brought us up, and she did a wonderful job, and she was a wonderful mother.
And it was you and an older brother. And, I mean, these are the Depression times in Southern California. What do you remember about those years?
I was on my own most of the time. My mother did the best she could to raise us, and we moved around different places in Pasadena and then Altadena and so forth. And I was in the Boy Scouts there for a while and got up to Star Scout, and then we moved. And that was the end of my scouting career. But I do remember the father figure that I remember was a Deputy Sheriff Shermer. He was the head of our scout troop, and we thought the world of him, and I still do to this day.
And is that when you first got turned on to woodworking? Because there's not a room in this house that doesn't have something that you have cut and sanded and routered and beveled, and I mean, literally every room has something made out of oak. And I know I drove past Live Oak and Fair Oaks on the freeway here. Those are the exits, but I didn't expect to see this much oak in your house. When did you catch that woodworking bug?
I started woodworking about, well, I'd been in this house for some time, and what we did is we built it. I did all the electrical originally and the painting, and my wife and I together did the painting. But as far as building anything, I didn't build anything until years later. I almost retired. My wife wanted some cabinets in this one room in the house, and so we got an estimate, and the guy was going to charge me so much. We couldn't do that at that time. We couldn't afford it. So then I started asking questions and looking around, talking to people that did woodwork, and looking at furniture stores, how to build stuff, and I started in the garage. My wife was impressed with what I did, and so we started getting me power tools and different stuff, and so that I learned. And how I really got started with this was when we joined the LDS church and they talked about food storage. I hired a guy to build some cabinets in my garage for food storage, and he was doing such a lousy job and cost me so much money that I had to fire him. And here I'm stuck with a whole pile of wood and didn't know what to do with it. So started asking questions, and I started building in the garage and one room at a time and doing little things there. And over the years, I built everything in the house. I built the deck on my house. When I was 72, my deck is 50 feet by 20 feet, kind of overhangs the slope going to the creek. And I did that by myself. There was this fascia board that's 2x8, 16 feet long. And I think I put that up by myself. I couldn't do it today. How I did it, I don't know. But I built so much stuff in this house that now I'm glad it's done, because at my age, I couldn't do this anymore. That's about it.
Well, that's not what I heard. And it's interesting that this was born out of necessity, not of interest, as you just described for us, and really is impressive in every room in the house, the craftsmanship and workmanship. I can tell your attention to detail. But I understand there's even a popular restaurant here in Arroyo Grande that you're still doing some woodwork for?
Country Kitchen. I built stuff for him in his old place. I built his whole office in his restaurant. And so when he moved over to this new location, then I started building stuff over there for him. But I'm still doing little things for him, but not as much, because I discovered one thing. Building this stuff, I'm getting old now.
But if someone wants to get a taste of some of your handiwork, they can go to Francisco's Country Kitchen here?
Yes, that's right.
Well, and you wouldn't have had a chance to make any of these masterpieces if you didn't make it through World War II, and we're going to get to your time in the Navy. But what else about your childhood stands out? Because, I mean, kids today may not understand what it was like during the Depression and some of the things that you had to do just to make life go. Do you remember any of those things that maybe stand in pretty stark contrast to today's world?
Yes. My life has been one big adventure after the other. So many things I can remember. A neighbor one time, he says that he went up at June Lake, and he had some friends up there, and so we hitchhiked up there, and we rented boats out there for the whole summer, and we lived in a tent. But that was just one minor thing. Another time, this friend of mine, he lived in South Dakota, or he came from South Dakota, and he had a family back there, and he asked me, he says, "Dick, you want to go back to South Dakota with me?" And I said, "Sure, why not?" You know. And so we hitchhiked back there, and back in South Dakota, and his family that he thought he had back didn't turn out too much. And so we did little odd jobs and different things, and finally I ended up working in a carnival, Howard Amusement Company. I worked on the tilt-a-whirl. I was 15 years old at the time, and we'd set up the things, and at midnight we'd tear down to go to the next town, and then we'd load the tilt-a-whirl and the different stuff on the trucks. And the truck I had was a steak truck with a tilt-a-whirl on the back, and I had to drive that truck to the next town at 15 years old, and nobody with me. Anyway, the roads are so narrow there in South Dakota that I had to aim the truck the whole time. And we'd get to the next town, we'd look for a park and crash on the lawn, and until it's time to get up, we'd set the thing back up again the next time. But I do remember one time, one place, I was walking by the stands where they have the guns and stuff shooting and the milk bottles tossed, and I was walking by and this baseball come rolling out toward it. It was about 50 feet from the stand itself. I picked it up, and I guess the people there, they backed off so that I could throw the ball back, and about 50 feet away, and I took that baseball, and I threw that baseball to those milk bottles about 50 feet away, and I hit them square. They went flying, and everybody says, "Give him a big teddy bear." I says, "I can't, I work here." That was one of my experiences. And another experience I had, went hitchhiking, and I remember I got to Boulder, Colorado. It was getting nighttime, and here I didn't have a place to sleep or anything. So I saw a policeman, and I was talking to him, and he took me to the jail. He put me in the jail for the night. Didn't take my fingerprints or picture or anything. He just put me in the jail, and the next morning he gave me some oatmeal, sent me on my way, and that was it. So I don't have a record of being in the police department, but anyway, so my older brother had taught me to try to ride the rails, and so I got on this riding the rails, some boxcar back then. I got to Albuquerque, New Mexico. So I didn't know what to do, and I was walking down this one road past these farms, and so I went up to this one farmer and asked him if he needed some help, and he hired me, and I stayed there for about maybe 6 months. I don't know. He talked me into writing my mother a letter and stuff, but anyway, I stayed in the corn crib, and I do remember one time it snowed, and outside of the corn crib was a little cover of snow on the ground, but I was plenty warm in that corn crib, and I learned how to harness a dapple gray draft horse team and a mule team, and I'd learned how to drive them, and I became a mule skinner and a draft horse skinner. And one time I had to do some plowing on a field for new alfalfa, and they put me on this Caterpillar tractor, I think it was before sunup, start plowing, and then they bring my lunch out in the middle of the day, and at dark they'd come out and get me and learn things that I never even knew before, because I'm a city guy, and I didn't know what a clevis was before. Now I know what a double tree is, and how to yoke the big horses and stuff and drive them, how to load the alfalfa on a wagon, and that's quite a job in itself, trying to steer these two draft horses in front of me and load the alfalfa at the same time. And I do remember one time I had a Sunday off, So I took one of the draft horses, and I thought I'd ride him around bareback. The only thing about those horses, you can't neck rein them. They're team horse, so you got to pull the reins one at a time to steer them. So I was riding this big draft horse. They got a kind of a smooth back, so to ride him bareback was kind of a comfortable situation. And I was riding down the street on the side of the street, and I wanted to see how fast this draft horse would go. And so I was going as fast as I could, and this car come along beside me, and they rolled his window down, and he says, "You're going 35 miles an hour." So I have ridden bareback on a draft horse going 35 miles an hour. And so anyway, I finally went back home, and the next adventure was my brother had a job in this logging camp in up northern California, and he asked me to come, and he says he's got a job for me up there. So when I got up there, my brother had left. He'd gone somewhere else. I was stuck by myself. So they put me a set in chokers. The chokers is where you put a big chain around the log and hook it to the back of a Caterpillar tractor, and they haul it to the landing. They thought that I was too young to do a dangerous job like that. They got me these boots with spikes on them so that you could walk around on the logs. But anyway, they thought that was too dangerous. So they put me as an oiler on the power shovel. They were building a logging railroad. And this logging railroad in Northern California, what the shovel would do, it, you go on and smooth it out, and the bulldozers would go ahead also. But the powder monkeys had put their dynamite in the mountains and set that off. And then one time I remember they set it off 15 tons of dynamite, and we had to go to the other side of the hill when they set it off. When we come across a big rock that the shovel couldn't lift up, we'd put a pile of dynamite on top of it and put a little igniter in there, run the wire back behind one of the big tracks on this power shovel, and then we had a little hand crank and we'd set it off to blow it up. And I did that also a couple of times. This guy let me do it, and he also tried to teach me a little about running the power shovel, which I did a little bit. Winter time, they closed up because snow and stuff and sent everybody home. And the next year I got a letter asking me to come back and work for them again. But that time I was in Pasadena. I went to work as an office boy for the Singer Sewing Machine Company, and I had quite a little experience there. And after that, I worked in the parking lot, parking cars behind this drugstore. Then the next thing you know is I joined the Navy.
Well, and, you know, I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of World War II veterans, and most of them, the most dangerous thing they ever did in their life was what they did in World War II. It kind of sounds like everything you did before you joined the Navy might have even been more dangerous than the Navy.
Yes, probably was. I guess so. But my life has been exciting, interesting. I'm an adventurer, and I've always been an adventurer. I quit school in 1941 when I first started high school because there was a war coming on. I didn't know what was going to happen. And I finally graduated from the same high school I started. I graduated in 1951. So it only took me 10 years to get through high school. I got out of the Navy, took the GED, and then went to night school and got my diploma from night school. So only took me 10 years to get through.
And what was the high school?
Mark Keppel High.
Another thing you said when you were telling us about some of those adventures, you said finally the farmer said, "You need to write your mother a letter." I don't think I was the only one listening to that thinking, what did his mother think about all this when you're 15 and 16 years old and hitchhiking and riding the rails all over the country? How did she feel about that?
I don't know, but I'll tell you one thing. My mother, something that happened later on in the Navy, lets me know that the ones what really suffer when something happens. When I was overseas, she's got a 17-year-old son in World War II, and she gets a telegram from the War Department, and all it says is, "We regret to inform you that your son has been wounded in action." So I wasn't able to write her letters. They were censored. Everything was censored. So for another year, she didn't know what was wrong with me. And I think back, and I think about how my mother must have suffered thinking about that. You know, I think about it every day, and I think about things like that. My mother went through some hell with me. I wasn't the ideal son, believe me.
On another question that came to mind as we heard about some of your adventures, do you remember where in that whole journey, where you were on December 7th, 1941, and how you found out that America had been attacked?
Well, I was 15 years old on December 7th, and I didn't join till 1943 when I was 17. That didn't really be a big moment in my life. I didn't think too much about it at the time. I think that everybody knew that something was coming along, and when it happened, it happened. And that was about it. And here, a 15-year-old kid, I didn't know what to do. I was into my adventures anyway.
So then you're 17, and you decide you want to go in the Navy. At 17, that means you had to convince your mother to sign for you, right?
Yes, I did, and that was a problem, but she did sign. I guess she felt it was a thing to do, and I told him I wanted to be a quartermaster because I wanted to be above decks, and I was interested in navigation anyway, and that was it. So I signed up and went to San Diego.
And how could you possibly imagine what that Navy adventure was going to hold? I mean, you didn't even know what a kamikaze was at that point. It would almost end your life. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with Richard Grantham of Arroyo Grande, California. He participated in 4 major Pacific battles during World War II, and we're going to hear about some of those, including the day that almost claimed his life in January 1945. If you'd like to see what this active nonagenarian looks like now and what he looked like as a teenage sailor, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we're going to come right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Dick Grantham of Arroyo Grande, California, where he's going to celebrate his 93rd birthday on July 11th. We heard about some of his unique adventures as a teenager, hitchhiking, riding the rails, driving a tilt-a-whirl truck with the carnival, operating dangerous logging equipment, even riding a draft horse 35 miles an hour bareback, all before he enlisted in the Navy at age 17 in 1943. And what was it about the Navy that attracted you? Because I'm sure you could have waited a little longer, been drafted into the Army. You could have tried to get into the Marine Corps or maybe something in the air. What was it about the Navy that you liked?
Well, I don't know. The sea. I think it was the sea. I was interested in the sea. I do remember one thing in boot camp in San Diego. First couple of nights, I see some of the guys in their bunks, they were crying. You know, I thought, wonder what they're crying about, and realized that, well, they must really had some home. With me, it was different, entirely different. When I got in the Navy in the boot camp, I had a place to sleep. They supplied me with clothing and food. I was all taken care of, you know, for the first time. And so just another job to me.
A lot better than having to rely on the sheriff letting you sleep in the jail in Colorado, huh?
Yeah, right. I guess so.
Or riding the rails. I mean, it's a different world, and so many of us can't identify with that. And you're giving us a taste of what it might have been like. So you're in the Navy. You want to be a quartermaster. Were there some challenges along that path? Were there some things that were difficult maybe to grasp or master or deal with?
Well, the only thing about quartermaster school is the school itself. We had to learn celestial navigation. We had to learn the rules of the road, the names of all of the flags. We had to learn semaphore and Morse code. So I was able to go through all of that and with the cloud conditions. There's a name for each type of cloud. I used to know the names of all the different, and the sea conditions and white caps and stuff. The quartermaster's job in the Navy, one main thing on his watch on the bridge, he had to log every little incident that happens in the quartermaster's log. So at the end of the watch, the officer of the deck would take the quartermaster's log and make a Reader's Digest version of it to go into the ship's log. So everything in the ship's log as always comes from the quartermaster.
A lot of responsibility for a kid who quit school at 15. Did you have a preference as to what kind of ship you ended up on? Did you have an idea in your head that I want to be on such and such a ship?
No. Oh, incidentally, when we left San Diego the first time and sailed down south down there, we crossed the equator, and we had a big initiation crossing the equator. They had a big throne in front of the bridge there for King Neptune to sit on, and we had a horrible, that's what they did to us. So when you start out, you're a polywog, and when you finish with all your initiations, you're a trusty shellback. So now I'm a trusty shellback. But anyway, the thing that was a horrible thing that we had to go through. Anyway, what I do remember is this is right in the middle of World War II. We lowered the ensign and two-blocked the Jolly Roger. And the Jolly Roger is a skull and crossbones black flag. And all day long, right in the middle of World War II, the Jolly Roger was two-blocked. And that for the whole thing. And I often wondered, later on, I've wondered what would have happened if some Japanese submarine had come by and seen that Jolly Roger. But anyway, that never happened. But that was quite an experience. And then I was in Espirito Santo for 2 weeks, and Hollywood stars come by to entertain us. One of them was Bob Hope came to visit. And so I remember Bob Hope coming to entertain us there. Then I got assigned to a ship. I didn't know what ship I was going on or anything until I got there. And it was the USS DuPage, APA 41, which was a cargo ship with two holds forward and one hold aft, 5-inch cannon on the fantail and a 5-inch cannon on the forecastle, loaded with guns. When I got aboard, I felt, but I'm not even assigned to the ship. I'm assigned to the Commodore. When a Commodore was ahead of the whole landing fleet, and I was in his staff as a quartermaster. So I spent a lot of time in the chart room and, of course, duties on the bridge. So that was it.
I want to hear about your first taste of combat and all of that, but to help us understand what was expected of you, what was a typical day like for you? What were the duties that you had to carry out?
Well, I had to go and watch. Watch was a four-hour watch. We'd be on the bridge and log everything, the quartermaster's log, everything that happened during the whole watch.
Was it the same stuff over and over again, or was there always something that would break that monotony up?
Well, it was probably a lot of monotony, but a lot of things are the same, but it was always interesting being on the bridge, and I enjoyed every part of that. I liked it. I had a good time. I think I picked the right rate. It was a rate that I seemed to be good at, and I loved celestial navigation anyway, but the chart room, that was boring when I'd get in there. I'd have to make corrections on the charts. The thing that would happen was the Japanese had taken all these little islands over, so they wouldn't let us near them, you know. I always had the feeling that was Amelia Earhart flying over to learn more about these things. But anyway, when we finally taken these islands over, we had chart corrections and it put on the chart. That was kind of boring, but there was a lot of it and a lot of work to do, and that was about it.
This may seem a little silly, but I'm just thinking about all the people listening. And, you know, we have people anyway from your age down to not even teenagers yet listening right now. They live in a world where you have GPS on something you hold in your hand, and that tells you instantly where you are on the globe. You guys didn't have that, and you talked about celestial navigation. So for someone who's never done that, doesn't understand it, how do you explain what that is and how it works, how you figure out where in the world you are?
One main tool was a sextant. We had to know the stars, names of the different stars. And now the difference between a star and a planet, a star twinkles, a planet doesn't. But anyway, we had to learn all about where the different stars, there were star charts that we'd go by, and we'd look at a certain star with a sextant. We'd get that star right in our sextant and bring that star right down to the horizon with a sextant and take a bearing on it. And then also the time, the instant that we took that bearing on our stopwatch, we'd find out the time. And then we'd look at another star in a different direction, and we'd take a sight on it, and then with a sextant we'd bring it down to the horizon and take a bearing on it and the time again. And where the two lines would cross is where we were at the sea. And if it was a cloudy condition and there were no stars, then we'd go by what they'd call dead reckoning.
And you said you also had to learn semaphore, what the flags mean, Morse code, blinking lights from other ships and from your ship that would communicate. And you talked about your APA. You said it's a cargo ship with two holds forward and one aft, but the cargo was people, invasion troops, right? I mean, that was the purpose of your ship, to take invasion troops to these islands in the Pacific.
2,000. Each ship had 2,000, and the Commodore, he was head of the whole landing fleet. Now, I don't know how many ships were in that, but they're all kinds of landing craft.
So what was the first invasion that you were a part of on that APA?
The first invasion I was in is called Peleliu. Peleliu is an island in the Pacific in the Palau. Peleliu was the main one, and in that we took our 2,000 troops and we landed them there. The thing is, I got to know some of them. I have great respect for the Marines because the Marines, to me, are the heroes of World War II. When this one Marine, it was his first invasion, and it was my first invasion. And so we'd sit on the deck of the ship and we'd talk about different stuff. He told me that he could hardly wait to get ashore and start killing. And I thought, well, he must have learned something different in his boot camp than I did, because you wouldn't get considered killing. But apparently, when you're in a Marine, that's the thing you teach you, to kill. And he was really gung-ho. He was ready to go ashore. So anyway, we did have the landing at Peleliu, and he went ashore with the rest of them. And two or three days later, he came back to the ship. He was slightly wounded. And so we were talking to him then about it. I says, how's it there? And he says, Dick, he says, I don't want to go back. I just want to go home. I don't want to kill anybody else. I just want to go home. But he says, I know I'm going to have to go back again because I'm slightly wounded. And they fixed me up, and I know I'm going to have to go back. And, of course, he did go back, and I never heard from him. But I do know the second day of the operation, the whole Peleliu looked like a great big gray cloud. I saw the one airplane go by and crash into that gray cloud. Our guns were going off for a whole month, 24/7. All of our guns on our ship, and I remember the shells just covered the deck, empty shells, after the 5-inch shot them, you know. And then we had a battleship and next to us it was going off all the time. And the second day of the operation, the Wind Talkers, they had their radio was damaged beyond repair. And so they needed asked for a volunteer to take some radio gear ashore. So here I am, 17 years old, not fully developed in the brain yet. And I thought, yeah, I want to go ashore. I want to see what it's like ashore, you know. And so I did. That second day, I went ashore. And I guess about 50 yards from the shore, I thought, Dickie, what the heck did you get yourself into? I thought, you idiot, you know. And so as we went ashore, one landing craft on one side of me was blown up, and all I could see is dead bodies floating all around, you know. And so anyway, I learned one thing on this occasion, that under no circumstances ever do you ever volunteer for anything. And I remember years later when I moved to Royal Grandy, one neighbor was a colonel in the Marine Corps. He says, Dick, you volunteered to go ashore at Peleliu? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, you know, you're a damn fool. And I figured that out right away, you know. And he says, you know how we volunteered in the Marine Corps? You, and you. And so the Marines are my heroes to me. They're the real heroes. That was Peleliu. We finally, after 30 days, the Army come and took over because there's no Marines left. They're all gone.
Yeah, the Marines took heavy losses at Peleliu. But I want to hear about what else you experienced. So you volunteer to go ashore. And you said you were taking radio equipment. This is to the Navajo code talkers, yes, who had their unbreakable code?
Yes, that was the Navajos, yeah.
So you met up with them and handed this over?
I just handed it to some Marine that was there. That's all I know. That's all I did. So I'm not one of the heroes. I was kind of a passenger on during the war. But the real heroes are the ones that are still there, that died there, and they're my heroes.
One you talked about, and it was very powerful hearing the before and after for that Marine before and after combat there at Peleliu. Were there people there, or maybe even later on, that you got to know very well, that you count among those heroes, the ones who never came home?
No, I really didn't get to know any of them except this one fellow that I did get to know pretty well. And I don't know whatever happened to him. But I do remember on the officer's wardroom where they converted into an operating room. And I'd have to go by there all the time. And I'd see these doctors operating around the clock. How they did that was... And I watched some of the Marines there being operated look pretty bad because I could see them as I walked by, you know. And it was, I felt, well, those guys, they're the heroes.
So you were there for a month, and that had to be exhausting. You saw things you'd never seen before. Do you remember what it was like after that? Was there concern, fear, anticipation that you're going to see more of the same as you moved on to the next battle?
I don't remember anything about fear. But what I do remember is that after that, we sailed around different places for a little bit, and that was when we went to our next invasion.
And that next invasion would be in late October 1944, when General Douglas MacArthur had his famous return to the Philippines at Leyte. Dick Grantham and the USS DuPage also landed troops in Lingayen Gulf in January 1945, and he would participate in the invasion of Okinawa in April aboard another APA, the USS Elmore. But in between came a day that almost ended his life, a day that saw 35 of his shipmates killed, four times that many wounded. The Purple Heart on his wall is a lasting reminder, and we're going to hear some of the story behind it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing, close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with almost 93-year-old Dick Grantham of Arroyo Grande, California. After his World War II service in the U.S. Navy, he spent 38 years working for the Bell Telephone Company. He has a few stories from those years, too, and his house here in California's Central Coast is a telephone museum of sorts. You can find just about every iteration of telephone technology, from the wood wall phone to the candlestick phone, the rotary dial phones you may have grown up with. And they're not just there to look at. Most of them actually still work. You can hear them ringing. And he's also still hard at work with his hobby of woodworking, even decking out a local restaurant in Arroyo Grande with his skilled craftsmanship. In World War II, working with wood was the furthest thing from his mind. He was a teenage quartermaster aboard the attack transport USS DuPage. Dick told us about his experiences at Peleliu when his ship lost three landing craft in a battle that would rage on that island for more than 2 months and cost more than 2,300 American lives, with more than 8,000 more wounded. Dick himself would end up wounded about 4 months later, but before that, there was another battle to participate in. Where did you find yourself, Dick, as an 18-year-old in October 1944?
Leyte Gulf. And Leyte Gulf, I'm told it was the biggest sea battle of World War II. I always thought the Coral Sea was the biggest, but now they tell me that Leyte Gulf was the biggest of all. So anyway, we were there for quite some time, and that's when MacArthur went to shore, said he'd returned, you know. But anyway, that was quite a battle in itself. And I don't know how long we were there, but that was quite some time. Yeah, and I did, after we secured it, we did go ashore, and I talked to some of the natives there, and I got this knife, a curved knife that they carried all the time. And it was all hand-carved handle, and I still got it in my living room. I traded that knife, and I still got it out of my fireplace in my dining room. Traded it for the two packs of cigarettes. And in those days, overseas, the cigarettes would cost us a nickel a pack because there's no tariff or anything on. No. Anyway, I got that whole souvenir that I have today and I cherish that cost me 10 cents.
And 75 years later, it still looks nice and sharp. I saw it up there on the wall. So what were you doing personally during that Leyte Gulf situation?
Well, when we're in a battle like that, it's usually four on and four off. So it was busy. We're always here on the bridge or resting, sleeping or in the mess hall or something. So I didn't have any really time for just relaxing or being worried about anything. I know it was quite some time. I do remember one thing that struck me. The whole sky looked like it was breaking out with the measles. So the anti-aircraft would shoot at the kamikazes. There's a lot of kamikazes, but they seem to just be flying right through this mess and never get hit. However, I do remember one time our ship did shoot a kamikaze down, and here this kamikaze guy going, poor guy going to his death, you know, and here on board we're cheering like it's a football game, hooray, we got him, you know, and. I think, what a thing to cheer about some guy going to his death. But at that time, I was one of the cheerers, you know, and I didn't know any different. But there's one difference right there when I think about it. When you interview somebody, the Marines or the Army, usually these guys can't talk about their experience because they've had to actually kill somebody. So they won't talk about their experiences. With me in the Navy, we didn't see the enemy. I do remember one time they brought a prisoner aboard ship, and a Japanese prisoner, and I didn't know hate for him or anything. So some poor Japanese guy, he probably didn't know any more what's going on than I did, you know. But as far as the hate goes, I don't remember ever feeling any really hate for the Japanese ever. But a guy that had to do the killing, they won't talk much about it. With me, it was just a cruise ship turned to war, if you want to call it that.
And you said you didn't see the enemy, but apparently the enemy saw your ship because a kamikaze eventually crashed into your ship, and we're going to hear about that. But you mentioned the knife that you traded a couple packs of cigarettes for, and on the opposite side of that room here in this house that you've built everything in, you actually have a wheel that would steer a ship. It's like the helm of your ship is right there in that room. And that's something you did on this ship as a teenager? You were steering the way?
Oh, I did steer a lot of steering on that ship. Yes, I sure did. Quartermaster takes over the helm at the general quarters or in and out of port or refueling at sea. But there, in my case, it was a little different up until my last invasion, which was Okinawa. But before that, I was in the Commodore's staff. So being in the Commodore's staff, the ship's company would take all the duty of the ship, and so I was like a fifth wheel. They didn't know what to do with me, so they assigned me to a gun, and I was on a gun crew, and that gun crew was on the port side of the ship, just forward of the fantail a little bit with that was a 1.1 gun at the time, and there was a whole crew of us in there on the port side. That's the ship that the kamikaze did land on right there and destroyed that whole port side of the ship. And my gun crew, I guess I'm the only one that survived, from what I hear, and all the others died instantly. And I even had one of my friends was on a 240, and he and I were really good friends. And he was from Fontana. We'd talk about different things back in, when we'd go to the Moonlight Rollaway in Pasadena and different stuff. And we were talking about it. He says, well, if one of us dies accidentally, if one of us dies, the survivor will go visit the other's parents. Well, neither of us had any idea that anything would happen to either of us. Well, I had to visit his parents. And he there's another thing. His parents, that was their only son. And they got the letter from the War Department that says, we regret to inform you that your son has been killed in action. And what those parents went through, I never forget. My mother, for a year, she didn't really know what was really wrong with me. So my poor mother had to suffer, and my dear mother is really dear to me. I feel really remorseful for that, what she had to go through there.
Well, and as you said, your friend's mother became a Gold Star mother. Her son was killed in that same incident that wounded you. Do you remember his name, that sailor from Fontana?
Yes, I do. John Shriver. And the first thing that they asked me was, Johnny Shriver, they said, I've got a picture of him lost up upstairs. But anyway, they asked him, did he suffer? The first thing they asked me, did he suffer? And I says, no, he didn't suffer. He was dead before he knew anything was happening. It was instant. Because with me, it was like I was being barbecued in a microwave instantly, and I didn't know what was. My first indication was I thought maybe the 5-inch cannon on the fantail had backfired. So I didn't know. The heat was so tremendous, that terrible, terrible, terrible heat. And I remember trying to get away from that heat, and I backed into this thing, a magazine. I thought, oh, there's bullets in there. I better get out of here. And you think of a million things in split second that don't happen otherwise. And so I remember that there's other guys that were trying to get down this one ladder that goes down onto the fantail. And I figured these guys needed that ladder better than I did. So I climbed over the side, and it was about a 10-foot drop. And I dropped to the fantail, and because trying to get out of the heat was so horrible. I never felt any heat like that in my life, ever. I hope I never do again. But anyway, I remember there was guys jumping off the fantail there into the water, and I was about ready to jump in the water myself, you know, because we thought the ship was going to sink. Because the whole thing was nothing but fire. And so I looked over the side of that. It was nighttime, black, inky water there. And I thought of octopuses and sharks. And I thought, I'm going to try to take my chance a little longer aboard of a chicken, I guess. And so it pays to be chicken. And the ship didn't sink, though. It pays to be chicken. So then the next thing I knew, I was in line. I don't know how I was got in line, but there's a guy behind me, a guy forward from me, and we were pushed along. And I remember I run under this one guy, and he says he's bleeding in the face. And I've had to have anger. So I gave him my handkerchief, and then we all went midships. And that midships, there was a warrant bosun kind of directing traffic. And so he pointed, some of them he pointed down to go down, and the others he took pointed to go up, you know. And so when I came up there, pointed me down. And I at this time, you just follow orders. You don't know what's going on, you know. And so I went down, and lo and behold, I was in sick bay. And in sick bay, there was things. The corpsmen were overwhelmed, and there were stretchers to carry, or there was bandages to help guys get in, caught, and legs gone off, and it was horrible in there. So I started carrying stretchers and help bandaging stuff, and helping. It was about 2 hours later, you know. And about 2 hours later, one time we were down there over the loudspeaker, they said that on this bomber, it was a bomber that landed on our twin-engine bomber that landed on our ship. And one bomb went off. The bomb that went off was about, I guess, 25 feet from where I was standing. And but it went and it destroyed the whole gun crew except me. But anyway, there were a couple of heroes to go to throw the bomb over the side that didn't go off. And about 2 hours later, things begin to settle down pretty good. And so one of the corpsmen come by and he says, "Okay, Dick, it's your turn." And I says, "For what?" And he says, "Look at your arms." Well, from my waist on up, I was burnt and there was blood all over it. I didn't realize. Here I was working and doing stuff and I didn't, I guess they call it suffering from shock or something. But I didn't feel any, the pain I originally felt was that heat when the thing first went off. It was horrible, horrible heat. That really hurt. But after a while, I was just busy doing stuff and carrying stretchers and band. I didn't think about it. And here, my arms are all bloody. My upper part of my body was burnt. And so they put these big grease all over me, some kind of grease, and then bandages, prop my arms up. So I couldn't even move my arms after that because the bandages kept my arms almost straight out. And so I couldn't do anything. So I was able to walk up to the bridge and up able to get to the bridge, but I couldn't do anything. I couldn't even move my arms or anything except for these doggone bandages that were up there. But that was it. And as far as pain goes, I think to this day, the one that really suffered was my mom. Kind of brings tears to my eyes to think about what my mom must have went through. And now that I have kids of my own, I just think 17-year-old kid in a situation like that, and you get that telegram, must have almost killed her.
Well, and we know it definitely came close to killing you. And the reality is it did claim the lives of 35 men aboard your ship. 136 others were wounded as a result of that bomber deliberately crashing into the DuPage on January 10th, 1945. And, you know, I really hate to do this, but I think we're going to have to carry this conversation into our next episode of Hometown Heroes. And I say that because I know we have a lot more ground to cover. I want to hear more about how you experienced that kamikaze attack. I want to hear about your recovery from those extensive injuries. We didn't talk at all about Halsey's typhoon, which you experienced firsthand and even had to guide your ship through. And even after the Japanese surrendered, you had an up-close and personal view of an atomic bomb at Bikini. So we're going to look forward to all of that and more next time with Dick Grantham, who, hey, by the time of that airing, will have celebrated his 93rd birthday. So happy early birthday, Dick. Don't forget to check out the photos and video of Mr. Grantham online at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And thank you so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, inviting you to join us again next time for the rest of Dick's unique life story. And I know, as we are each and every time by these memories from our veterans, we'll be reminded once more that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all a reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.